Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. See? Told ya. Deep breath. Everybody will do the trick every single time. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, the 15th day of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. No, a deep breath is not a cure-all, but on a day-in, day-out basis in unsteady economic times, I think it's a pretty good go-to, honestly. Case in point, today. Yes, yesterday was ugly. The bond market was this week's sign the apocalypse is upon us. And then this morning, hello, American consumers. Retail sales numbers came out today, up sharply last month compared to June, ahead of expectations, in point of fact. So, with the apocalyptic bond market on one end, consumers on a spending spree on the other, and the stock market in the middle doing who knows what, Marketplace's Kimberly Adams explains the mixed messages this economy is sending.
With all the headlines about a possible looming recession, it's worth noting the economy, at least for now, is still doing okay. Mickey Levy is a chief economist at Berenberg Capital Markets.
There's a clear disconnect between the economy that's growing, you know, pretty close to its potential path, and bond yields that are signaling something quite negative.
Traders see troubles ahead. The ongoing U.S.-China trade war, Brexit, a global manufacturing slowdown. Regular consumers, whose spending is the main driver of the American economy, they're not too worried about it. Brad McMillan is with the Commonwealth Financial Network.
When you look at consumer confidence, it's actually quite high. And they're not only saying things are good, they're actually voting with their wallets by spending.
Which is, ironically, exactly how people tend to behave heading into an economic downturn.
American consumers in that environment spend like sailors on leave.
Brian Gildenberg is with Kantar Consulting.
You know, it's like, well, I may not have a job in a year. We better go get the big screen TV now while I still have income. It's a very American response to a potential future slowdown.
Rather than doing something crazy like saving for a rainy day or, you know, a recession. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
The economic indicator du jour, as I said, was retail sales. So a retail story now about a bellwether retailer. Walmart announced profits today. Boatloads of profit is, I think, the technical term. Marketplace's Amy Scott is on that one.
Most Americans live within 10 miles of a Walmart. When consumers do well, so do those stores. And, says Scott Hoyt with Economy.com, by and large, consumers are doing well.
Jobs are available, income growth is healthy, and we're seeing that in continued healthy to strong consumer spending growth.
Not all retailers are reaping the benefits. JCPenney said today its sales fell 9% last quarter. Yesterday, Macy's lowered its outlook for the year. Analyst Neil Saunders with Global Data Retail says many traditional retailers are struggling to connect with shoppers.
And the worrying thing is they're struggling to do so even in a reasonably benign consumer environment.
So what is Walmart doing right? For one thing, selling groceries, says analyst Garrett Nelson at CFRA, something people need.
They're more of a consumer staples name, so we think they're much more favorably positioned than some of the discretionary names.
The company's also been investing big time in e-commerce. Online sales were up 37%, driven partly by customers ordering, again, groceries online and picking up at the store. By next year, the company plans to offer curbside pickup at more than 3,000 stores and delivery from 1,600 logistics centers, a way bigger footprint than its rival that starts with AMA and ends in Zon. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, a little bit bumpy, but hey, Emma and Zon, come on, that was good. Better than yesterday on Wall Street is what I was saying. Details, numbers, you know the drill. We are just about halfway through the month as of today. It's also midweek-ish, which, according to the Marketplace internal programming calendar, means it's time to crack open a fresh episode of our series, Conversations from the Corner Office. Today, Matt Brun. He's the general manager of the Pabst Brewing Company. Beer, of course, Pabst Blue Ribbon, PBR, for 100-something years now. But here in the 2019 world of changing consumer tastes, Brun's job is to get the company diversified, I guess. Matt Brun, good to talk to you.
Thank you very much.
There will be those who listen to this interview who somehow have not heard of Pabst Blue Ribbon.
Well, have they been living under a rock?
You know, I don't know.
175 years, they should have heard of us by now.
What? I mean, just to get to the beer roots of this thing,
yeah,
and where you're going with it. Pabst for a long time was, and look, I was, well, not of legal drinking age, but it was in the same league as like Rheingold and Schlitz,
yep,
right? Old Milwaukee, probably.
Yes.
And then it went away for a while in the public consciousness, and then came back sort of, I'm going to use this word, in hipster land.
Yeah, totally. So,
oh, you're owning it. That's interesting.
Oh, absolutely. Biggest brand in America in the 70s, craters in the 80s. By 1999, it's, you know, a tenth the size it was at, yeah, its peak, and it's dead. It's literally declining at 20%. Without the hipsters from Portland, Brooklyn, and around the country picking it up, it would be pretty much out of market by now.
Hmm.
I mean, 2003 to 2010, give or take, the brand was just on fire. Sadly for us as a company, those hipsters that were, you know, mid-20s in 2003, yeah, got married, had kids, and, you know, no longer drove, you know, culture in America. So, you know, our challenge now is, you know, to go beyond the hipster movement and make it the real choice of who's coming through now and driving culture. And they don't look like, you know, the people that drive culture in 2003 don't look like,
right,
the people driving culture now, right?
And you're doing it not with beer. Explain.
We're doing it with
beer, but.
With beer. We've, right, done in-beer thinking, but we recognize not everyone drinks beer.
Yeah.
We've launched alcoholic coffee. We've done a whiskey, which is a real remembrance to Jacob, the original founder.
Does it taste? I mean, we're going to taste it here in a bit, but does it taste like moonshine?
No.
Because I've had moonshine, and that's no,
yeah,
fun.
It's not. It's definitely not moonshine, right, that's for sure. It, all took, right, me 18 months to create it, so hopefully it doesn't taste like
moonshine. You did it? You're the guy?
Yeah, the distiller and I had 12 years of experience in the spirits industry.
Right.
The head distiller from New Holland, distilling in Grand Rapids. And I spent the last sort of 18 months going through different mash bills, grain types, working through how we distill it. And look, it's not going to be something you sip neatly, quietly by the fireside. It is something you're definitely going to want to mix. But much like gin or vodka or kind of Blanco tequila, it's made to mix, right?
Yeah.
But it doesn't have the harshness or the kind of the pungency of a moonshine.
You are building a brand here, right?
Mm-hmm.
How did you start thinking about it when you got this job? Taken Pabst from what it was, you know, even with the hipsters, right? It's,
sure,
different now than it was with the hipsters.
100%. Yeah, so when I landed in LA and looked at the PBR brand, we're like, okay, here is a brand that people have chosen to badge themselves as outside the kind of homogenous, nationalized identity, right? So the stuff we're launching, we're not trying to go national with everything. We're going, okay, let's try this in this market, this in this market. Like, have heaps of bets.
Right.
You know, have a little bit here, a little bit there. We've actually got hard coffee going. We've got whiskey about to go. We've got a stronger seltzer. So we're basically saying, okay, how can we be as fast and innovative as possible in multiple places?
And then you'll pick the one that works. If all three hit, then you run with them. And if it's just the seltzer, then you go with the seltzer.
Yeah, pick a winner. Look, they might all win and they all go, right? They might all, mm-hmm, one might win and two might lose, but, right, we'll basically incubate and see what works.
So in 10-ish years, where is Pabst?
America's biggest enhanced drink.
Is that the lingo, enhanced drink?
Yeah. I mean, we make functional drinks, right? And you have to be open-minded to what those functional drinks might contain. Look at the shift going on. We've now got functional waters, kombuchas, green teas in a bottle, matches. We are in a constant search to make the liquid we put down our throat enhance our life, right?
Matt Brun, the Pabst. Thanks a lot.
No worries, buddy. Thanks for having us.
That was just a taste, if you will, of my conversation with Matt Brun. We've got the whole thing on our Corner Office podcast. Talked a little bit more, he and I did, about Pabst's history and Matt's experiences in spirits. And then, yes, as I said, Matt did bring whiskey samples with him. Yes, I did try it. Yes, we did get it on video. We put it on Twitter. We're at Marketplace. This is going to sound like a weird thing to say, but there's a lot of water out there in this economy this year. There's been farms flooded in the Midwest. We talked to Austin Golding, our barge guy, a couple of weeks ago about the problems the high water on the Mississippi River has been causing him. And the Great Lakes are at record high levels this summer as well. That is good, kind of better for shipping, but it's bad, kind of, along the shorelines. From Minnesota Public Radio, Dan Crocker explains.
In the past couple of years, the city of Duluth has learned the hard way just how powerful Lake Superior can be. Nearly 2 years ago, 60-mile-per-hour winds created waves that shredded seawalls and destroyed roads. 6 months later, another big storm caused more damage, and then last fall, a third storm hit. The waves were 20 feet tall. They ripped apart a section of the city's popular Lake Walk bike and pedestrian trail. Mike LeBeau is supervising the rebuilding. It will cost about $3 million. He says the storm was the worst yet.
That last storm on October 18 took away acres of land.
It tipped over lights, flipped over sections of the boardwalk. I'm talking to LeBeau on a much calmer day when Lake Superior looks like blue glass. He says the storms have taken a toll.
So it's been hard for the city to catch its breath, frankly.
All told, the storms caused nearly $30 million in damage. Lake Superior's gales are legendary, and LeBeau says high water has made recent storms even more destructive. It's a similar story elsewhere around the Great Lakes, where beaches have disappeared, docks are submerged, and lakeshore is eroding away. But the high water is a boon for the giant freighters that transport grain, iron ore, and other cargo across the lakes. That's because deeper water allows ships to carry more.
A great example of this is a vessel like the Edwin H. Gott, which can carry an additional 267 tons of iron ore per extra inch of draft.
Jason Rohn is a spokesperson for the Duluth Seaway Port Authority. He says just one extra inch of water allows the ship to carry an extra $26,000 of ore.
And then multiply it by more than 30 trips over the course of a shipping season, it adds up to some significant benefits.
It's hard to believe that only 6 years ago, the shipping industry was complaining about record low water. Great Lakes water levels began dropping quickly in the late 90s. That drop was fueled by warm lake temperatures, which led to high evaporation rates. Then, about 5 years ago, lake levels started to rise really fast. That was driven largely by an increase in rain and snowfall. University of Michigan environmental science professor Drew Grunewald says these rapid fluctuations between high and low water levels may be the new normal for the Great Lakes.
I do think it is prudent for any planning decisions to take a look at the historical highs and historical lows and recognize that at some point in the next couple of decades, it's extremely likely that we'll continue to oscillate between those two.
Which puts people who live and work along the lakes in a tough spot. Some landowners have moved their homes farther away from the eroding shore. But in Duluth, Mike LeBeau says that's not an option for the city's lake walk. There's no place to move it.
There are places where the solution is retreat. And there was nowhere to retreat here, so we have to do the best that we can come up with and afford and hope that it lasts a long, long time.
The city has hauled in giant boulders to bolster the lake walk and is building a thick concrete wall to protect it from big Lake Superior storms. In Duluth, Minnesota, I'm Dan Crocker for Marketplace.
Coming up.
He didn't like the way the new New York suits were treating him.
I know, right? How that changed software engineering straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, so here you go. Dow Industrial's up 99 points today, 0.3%, 25,579. NASDAQ down 7 points, less than a tenth percent, 77.66. The S&P 500 found 7 points, a quarter of a percent, 28.47 there. Walmart picked up 6% today after that positive earnings report we told you about. Bernie Madoff whistleblower Harry Markopoulos is targeting General Electric. Markopoulos said GE issued fraudulent financial statements to hide the severity of its problems. GE calls the report market manipulation for profit. Shareholders said nope. GE stock tanked 11.3% today, its biggest loss in 11 years. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note, get this, down to 1.49%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. To the bond market we go now with this mea culpa by way of introduction. Except for the days when it's going a little rogue, like yesterday, for instance, there is a tendency here and elsewhere to talk about the bond market as a single coherent thing. The bond market this or the bond market that, right? Thing is, the government borrows money by selling more than a dozen different kinds of debt, bonds, with maturities ranging from 4 weeks out to 30 years. And as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, those distinctions, oh, they matter.
Longer-term bonds normally pay higher interest than shorter-term bonds. But short-term bonds have advantages, too. Jeffrey Cleveland at Payden & Riegel says a one-year treasury bill might appeal to companies that need to store cash they can access quickly.
They keep a lot of money in the shorter maturities because it's effectively a savings account.
Then you have medium-term treasury notes, three-year notes, seven-year notes. Jim Vogel at FTN Financial says those appeal to investors who want to include safe government bonds in a portfolio and earn some interest income.
And that includes most banks, includes a lot of insurance companies, and then an awful lot of consumer-style investors that are investing through mutual funds.
Vogel says the really long-term bonds, we're talking 10 to 30 years, those appeal to big pension funds or university endowments who don't mind locking up their money for so long.
But then that's also where you see an awful lot of investors who buy and trade 10 and 30-year bonds when other assets begin to deteriorate in value.
Like, say, stocks. They go down, bond prices go up because they're a safe haven. That's why Putri Pasquale at PAMCO Prisma says investors pay such close attention to the 10-year treasury note.
It is the most actively traded segment in the bond market.
Another reason why we quote the 10-year treasury note every day when we do the numbers. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
All those Hollywood stars don't look that good all by themselves, you know. Yes, there is cinematic sleight of hand post-production, but even before people get in front of the camera, say for a quick spin on the red carpet, they've got some help. That's the segue to today's episode of our series, My Economy, Stories of People and How They Are Getting By.
My name is Jackie Mugito, and I am the CEO of Jackie Mugito Cosmetics. I'm originally from Zimbabwe. And when I was in Zimbabwe, I had a dream to just come to the United States and meet Oprah and do Oprah's makeup, because I always used to see this makeup all the time. So I started working on film and television and started working on a couple of celebrities. And I realized that there really was a gap, because they made products for specific, you know, women who are Caucasian or women that were light. And so this is when I went to my chemist. I found him and I said, listen, I have a project for you. I don't have money, but what I do is have experience. And he was like, let's do it. Our foundation bottle is slender and you can see the product. We have like 16 colors, from the lightest of light to the darkest of dark. It's amazing, because it's taken us literally 2.5 years to get this bottle right. Now, the problem is, for a container here that will cost me a dollar, in China, the container will cost me literally 15 cents. My husband, Kitani, is my business partner. We've put in a lot of money in this company. I specifically remember the day when the containers were coming, and I remember he called me and he was like, babe, I've got something to tell you. And I was like, why are you sounding weird? And he was like, man, this really ruined my day. It's $5,000. And I was like, what are you talking about? We've never paid $5,000. And he was like, the famous tariffs. And this is just for the first shipment. That was big. Because here it is. We feel like, oh my gosh, we're ahead. And then all of a sudden, we get dragged down, you know? Despite all these tariffs and despite all the craziness and the drama around it, the fact is I got the bottles and we filled the bottles. And my whole thing is, this is America. There's going to be a way.
Jackie Megiddo, makeup artist and entrepreneur there. We can only do this series if you help us out, you know? So please, share your story with us at marketplace.org. I learned a neat little trick the other day from an article I read in the New York Times. If you Google Thanos, you know, that big purple villain guy from the Avengers, and you click on the image of the glove with all the jewels on it that comes up, well, just try it. It's cool. Trust me. Anyway, that's what we call an Easter egg. It's a hidden treat coded into a product or a piece of technology for people to find. David Pogue wrote about the history of them in that article in the New York Times that I mentioned. David, welcome to the program.
Thanks.
So let's start with the not-so-secret history of Easter eggs. The first one was like 40-something years ago, 45 years ago, right?
Yeah. The story goes that this young game programmer named Warren Robinette was working for Atari, which got bought by Warner, and he didn't like the way the new New York suits were treating him, so they didn't give him credit for his work. So he took revenge by planting a credit screen, a tribute to himself, deep within one of his most popular games.
Segue to today-ish, and as we all know, software developers are, king of the land, actually. Why then are they still doing these Easter eggs if not for credit? Because they get credit all the time.
Yeah, that's true. It's interesting. Easter eggs are no longer a counterculture move. Nowadays, they're put in there for fun, for the entertainment of the programmers to boost morale, or they're put in there to delight the customer, or they're put in there as come-ons for potential programming talent by a software company. In other words, if you can find their Easter egg, you're clearly good enough to work there.
Well, tell me about that last one. It's you're referring to this company called Automattic, founded by the guy who did WordPress, right? His name is Matt Mullenweg, right?
That's right. If you look at a certain job description more than a few times, a message pops up and says, hey, you keep clicking this. Why don't you apply already? So his and there are others, too. He mentioned that there's one Easter egg on the Automattic.com homepage that fewer than a dozen people have ever found.
Yeah.
And he's hired almost all of them.
And he wouldn't tell you what it is, right? Because he wants to keep using it as that job test discriminator thing, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly right.
So I have a question. So the online version of this story in the New York Times has a video of the Tesla Model X doing, I mean, I guess Tesla calls it a dance, right? The headlights flash, the doors go up and down, and the windows fold in, all this jazz. That took developer time and energy and resources for Tesla to do, a company which is famously sort of struggling. How come they're doing this?
That comes up quite a bit in the comments.
Yeah.
You know, like, maybe you should spend less time making fun Easter eggs. Well, the story goes that these Tesla engineers went out in December 2015 to see a Trans-Siberian Orchestra concert. And at brunch the next day, they were like, you know, we have everything they had. We have lights, we have speakers, we have motion control. We should do something like that in the car. So they built this thing on evenings and weekends just for fun and didn't show it to Elon Musk until it was all finished. And he's like, I love this. So typically they're done off hours as moral crusades for fun.
Let's get back to the top of this and Warren Robinette. And I'm kind of proud of myself because I wrote this in my notes even before I got to your item about it in the story. Warren Robinette and Ready Player One, the Spielberg movie based on the book, of course, he features prominently. That Easter egg is like the key to that whole story.
That is. I mean, Warren Robinette planted that Easter egg in hopes of getting a little credit.
Right.
And now he's like a prominently, they name him three times in the dialogue of this otherwise completely fictional movie about, you know, a computer software world. And yes, the hero saves the day at the end by actually playing this 1975 Atari console game and unlocking Warren Robinette's original Easter egg in 2018.
David Pogue writing in the New York Times about Easter eggs and software. David, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
This final note on the way out today, which I will preface by saying I love The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, the Amazon series. In fact, we had Amy Sherman-Palladino and her husband Dan, the showrunners, on the program a couple of months ago. Marketplace.org. Check it out. The program, though, is up for like a zillion Emmys, as you may know. But in its latest four-year consideration marketing gimmick, Amazon clearly forgot to check with behavioral economists. The show is set in 1959, so Amazon subsidized a Chevron station in Santa Monica to sell gas today at the 1959 price, 30 cents a gallon. Humans being humans, chaos ensued. Streets and highways were jammed. Cops shut things down for a while. Behavioral economics, people, it's a real thing. All right, off we go. Dow Industrial's up 99 points today, 0.3%. NASDAQ down 7, less than 0.1%. The S&P 500, 7 up, 0.25%. Amir Babawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Heron Bekela, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.